Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 25, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the latest developments regarding the CFPB. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. We are pleased to once again have with us two gentlemen with a great deal of knowledge in this area, Wayne Abernathy, who is the Executive VP for Financial Institutions, Policy, and Regulatory Affairs for the American Bankers Association, and Jerry Lozer, who is of counsel at Winston & Strawn, LLP. I will turn it over to Wayne to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience Q&A, so please do be thinking of questions to ask. Thank you, gentlemen, for speaking with us today. Wayne, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Nate, and thank you for everybody who's participating in our call today. Again, my name is Wayne Abernathy, the American Bankers Association. I'm calling from inside the bubble here in Washington. Outside in real America is Jerry Lozer, who has been gathering together for the past month or so a list of interesting events, important events, curious events affecting the Consumer Bureau, which many of which we'd like to touch upon today. This is a continuation of an off and on again series that we do from time to time with Federalist Society members to discuss with them some of the important or interesting or valuable or just curious events taking place affecting the Consumer Bureau. Jerry and I are involved in the Federalist Society's Practice Group on Financial Services, and we together work with several others who are on the practice group that keep an eye on things financial, and the Consumer Bureau obviously is an important part of that. Over the last month or so, as I said, our colleague Jerry Lozer has been putting together more than a dozen notable Bureau events and activities up through January 10. We don't limit ourselves to January 10, but that's where the particular focus is. We're certainly happy to talk about some of the latest developments in recent weeks. Today we'll focus on several of these, after which we'll be happy to take calls to discuss these issues further that we tee up, or to go into other items that we did not mention but which may be of particular interest to you and which you think that others should take note of as well. With that, I'm going to hand the microphone over to Jerry to set the table for us and to list some of the topics we intend to address, and then we'll go into some of them in greater detail. Jerry?
Thank you, Wayne. We're going to focus on eight different topics this afternoon, starting with the possible removal of CFPB Director Cordray and a lot of controversy and news items that have been around that subject. Wayne is going to talk about a National Review article about the CFPB in the nature of an expose written by a former CFPB lawyer that is a very, very comprehensive and very insightful about some of the things that go on there. Then I'm going to talk about a development regarding the CFPB's consumer complaint narratives and an idea that is being propounded by an Indiana University law professor. And then Wayne will talk about some aspects, some of the intrigue around the pending rulemaking proposal at the CFPB concerning arbitration clauses and the proposal to outlaw them in consumer financial contracts if they waive a right to participate in class actions. And Wayne will talk about the fair lending priorities that the CFPB announced last month. I'm going to then talk about an enforcement action against MoneyTree that the CFPB brought. And then Wayne is going to come back in, and we're going to talk about the CFPB's asserted jurisdiction over certain types of hedge funds. And then I'm going to finish up talking about a recent employee survey that was released by the CFPB. The unifying themes, I think, among these eight topics is that we all probably agree, I think, that government should be responsive. It should attack genuine problems, not insignificant problems. It should be efficient. It should reward good performance, punish bad performance. And it's not clear based on these eight examples within the last month that that's really going on at the CFPB. I will start by talking about the possible removal of CFPB Director Cordray. The background on this is that the statute, Section 1011 of the Dodd-Frank Act, provides that the director of the CFPB may be removed by the President of the United States only for cause, which it defines as inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. If you follow these calls and developments of the CFPB, you may know that last November, there was a decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in a case captioned PHH versus CFPB. PHH is a major mortgage company. And the court held, a three-judge panel held, that the structure of the CFPB violates the separation of powers because it does not provide that the president, who has executive authority, of course, under Article 1 of the Constitution, it does not enable him to remove the head of a single director agency such as the CFPB at will. That decision is not effective yet because the CFPB has filed a petition for a rehearing en banc before the entire D.C. Circuit, and that has not been acted upon. And so until that decision becomes final and the mandate issues, it's really not effective yet. There have been suggestions by a University of Virginia law school professor that nonetheless the President of the United States does not need a court decision to follow the Constitution and can remove Director Cordray at will. There have been other articles to the contrary on that. And that's all by way of background, telling you that on December 28th, the Wall Street Journal published an article on this subject saying that former Texas Republican Congressman Randy Neugebauer, who is working with the Trump transition team, reported that the transition team is searching for cause to remove Director Cordray, and that cause could be widely reported discrimination against minority employees at the CFPB. It could be high building renovation costs that the CFPB has expended. It could be, and this was also widely reported, exaggerated accusations by the CFPB of racial discrimination by auto lenders. On January 9th, Republican Senators Ben Sasse from Nebraska and Mike Lee from Utah wrote then-President-elect Trump, urging him to remove CFPB Director Cordray. And the next day, January 10th, the Wall Street Journal actually published an editorial encouraging removal of Director Cordray. That same day, 21 Democrats from the House Financial Services Committee wrote, led by Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a Democrat from California, wrote to then President-elect Trump, urging him to keep Director Cordray, pointing out that no independent agency had ever been removed for cause, and threatening, quote, protracted legal battle, unquote, should Director Cordray be removed. And that letter interestingly acknowledged that there are employment discrimination issues at the CFPB, but the letter said similar issues exist at other agencies and suggested that Director Cordray is the only agency leader who's working to fight such discrimination. And the latest news on this subject is that yesterday there was a story that said the Trump team is still considering Director Cordray's fate. And this morning, the news is that 40 members of the Congressional Black Caucus have written to President Trump urging him to retain Director Cordray. Wayne, I think you, I don't know, you may have some thoughts on that subject that you might want to jump in on.
The only thing I'd add to that, that's an excellent summary, Jerry, of the legal situation as well as how the various parties are playing out their various views on Cordray's fate here in Washington and elsewhere. The only thing I'd add to that is a very interesting question of, let's say, what happens if the president does decide to remove Cordray, let's say not just for cause, just I want you out of there. I'm president, and you're part of the executive branch, and I want to put somebody else in place. And so, hasta la vista, you're on your way. Let's say Cordray wants to fight it in court. Does he get to remain in his seat at the Bureau while he's fighting it? There is some different debate about how that works out. I think the precedents, and there are not many, the precedents seem to suggest that, yes, you would be out of that chair. You would be out as private citizen while the courts would go through whatever they go through. And should the courts subsequently decide that you were wrongfully discharged, you could then perhaps receive back pay and some of the other emoluments of office, but that doesn't necessarily allow you to stay in your chair while the courts are going through their process.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting question. Again, not a lot of precedent, but some precedent, at least a couple of cases, and that seems to be how they've each played out.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to consider.
Yeah.
But related to that, Jerry, and if you don't mind, I'll step into this National Review article. Normally, we don't, in these conversations, we don't usually refer to a magazine article and say, here's something you really ought to look at. But I think it's worthwhile looking at that article because everybody keeps asking me if I've seen it. I hardly a day goes by without somebody saying, did you see that National Review article? And I have to say, well, yes, actually I have, because seven other people have asked me to look at it. This is a December 21 National Review article entitled, Conceived as a Government Watchdog with Noble Aims, the CFPB was doomed by a structure that made it an inherently political agency. Long title, but it explains really what that article's about, written by Ronald L. Rubin. And I think what's interesting and particularly about this article, in addition to the information that it presents, the author himself did work at the Bureau for a period of time, and he points out some of the things that he discovered and saw and witnessed while he was there for a period of time. And some of the things that he outlines in his article are very pertinent to what you've been talking about with regard to the status of the current director and how they've been operating and whether or not there are some reasons for even a for-cause discharge. The first point he talks about in his article is that the Bureau seems to have been designed intentionally as a political animal, that the incredible and unprecedented shielding of the agency from accountability was intentional by the authors of the legislation, putting that piece in the Dodd-Frank Act, ensuring that you had a sole director, so he didn't have any peers that he had to answer to. He'd be appointed for a period of 5 years, so whatever that period of office would go to extend beyond the next election. That this individual would not be subject to appropriations, so you couldn't impose accountability through the authorization and appropriations process, but instead the Bureau would be given basically a blank check to draw upon funds from the Federal Reserve, which itself is already insulated from accountability and answerability to Congress and to others. They'd have that barrier of the Federal Reserve between the Bureau and the Congress and other forms of accountability, and that all of that was intended to make sure that this agency could not be reached by the normal processes of public accountability. That's with regard to the way it's structured. And then Ronald Rubin goes through some of the ways this has played out. He points out that in his article, he was hired as the 13th enforcement attorney by the Bureau and was in their enforcement operations. And he says that there was, for example, an unwritten policy of the unit that he was involved with in dealing with congressional oversight, and their rule was, quote, never give them what they ask for. And if you look at how the Bureau has responded to requests for information from the committees of jurisdiction, almost in every case, the information is either provided in a delayed basis, in a partial basis, or the other tactic of providing a large amount of information not really related to the request at all, and avoiding appropriate oversight from the congressional committees. He says that was generally their practice, their general policy for dealing with the Congress. He also points out that in the enforcement effort, the Bureau would often, in deciding whom to sue and what kind of penalties to seek, they would target companies that had significant revenues available, and one of the first things in their investigation was to find out what the financial situation was of the company so they could decide how much they wanted to seek in the fines that they wanted to impose upon the company to pay. Many more very interesting things in that article, and as I say, we don't usually point people to magazine articles to look at, but this one has been so noteworthy, has been commented on by so many, and is relevant to this question about whether there are grounds for a for-cause dismissal of the director. It's probably worth taking a good read at it. Jerry?
Thank you very much, Wayne. I'm going to just talk for a minute about this impending LawReview article about the CFPB and consumer complaint narratives. One of the members of our practice group is Professor Todd Zawicki from George Mason Law School, and Todd forwarded this to the members of the committee on January 5th, and the article is called Calling on the CFPB for Help, Telling Stories and Consumer Protection, and the article will soon appear in a journal called Law and Contemporary Problems. It's by a law professor from Indiana University who is studying the role of emotion in law. To that end, he studied 5,000 consumer complaint narratives that were submitted to the CFPB, and he found that the complaints either expressed anger at the conduct of a company or expressed sadness about how the companies have affected their lives. And he recognized, of course, in the case of anger at companies, the CFPB has a mechanism to send those complaints on to the companies, and the companies can respond to them and maybe take action to eliminate the anger, but he points out that in the other case, the case of sadness about how companies have affected their lives, unfortunately the CFPB is not organized to provide individualized help to consumers, and the thrust of the LawReview article apparently will be that this is a wonderful opportunity for the CFPB to expand its role and to help individual consumers overcome the sadness that they may be experiencing because of their experiences in the financial system. Wayne, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but you might.
You know, you hardly wonder whether the Bureau needs incentives to do more things. One of the things that I have noticed in its several years of existence is how many different avenues it has been walking down with regard to not only what is clearly its jurisdiction, but also in an effort seems to be to expand its reach into different areas, as it's done, for example, into arrangements between college campuses and financial institutions that work with them. But here's another suggestion that maybe it ought to get into the how people feel about things. Maybe that's tied to the Bureau's reliance upon behavioral economics. That's getting into, again, some of this emotional response to financial services, and maybe that's a tie or connection there. But I think it would seem to be getting pretty loosey-goosey there, and you wonder to what extent is this the proper venue for a government agency.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like, I would like to – let me talk about arbitration. Because, again, this ties into some of the things we're talking about here, and it's a pending rule that goes back to the Dodd-Frank Act. The Dodd-Frank Act gave the Bureau some specific assignments, and one of them was to study the arbitration agreements that are found in many financial contracts, consumer financial contracts of financial institutions, and to examine whether or not, based upon the study, there's a need for any kind of regulation needed to rein in what the study would demonstrate to be abusive practices. The Bureau took a while but did its study and published its study, I believe, a little over a year ago. And the study, if you work way through it, has a lot of rhetoric finding fault with the arbitration agreements. The data that are presented, however, make a very interesting case. The data tend to contrast and compare arbitration resolutions versus class action resolution. And the data demonstrate that there is a very large discrepancy, both in time and in terms of return or reward to the customers, between arbitration and class action. And as you might guess, it's in favor, really, of arbitration. Very significant differences in how quickly resolution is brought to pass on various different complaints, and how the complainants are compensated where there are found to be damages and harm, and how frequently that occurs. With regard to class action, it takes a lot longer, and the returns are really rather paltry to the individual customers as composed to arbitration. Nevertheless, the Bureau, based upon that study, proposed a rule that would make it virtually impossible for financial institutions to offer arbitration as a means of resolving customer complaints. That was the Bureau's proposal. It went out for comment. Many commented pro and con. In fact, as I recall, there were huge numbers of comments that were provided on that were submitted on this. And the comment period has expired some weeks ago, and people have been expecting the Bureau to finalize their rule at any time. And in fact, and I'm going to make a disclosure here again, or raise a point that might threaten to make it sound like I spend a lot of time reading magazines. On December 26, Forbes reported that the Bureau was likely to issue its arbitration rule before President-elect Trump was to be inaugurated. The belief was this would be one of those rules that would be rushed through before there was a changing of the guard. Then I take us to on December 13, the Cause of Action Institute, which is a nonprofit group for open government, sued the Bureau under the Freedom of Information Act, seeking the Bureau's records that they used to support their view in the study that arbitration was inferior to class action. Even though the data presented in the study tell a different story, the Cause of Action Institute was seeking the data on which they the study was based. Well, here we are. No final rule and no indication of when that's going to happen. Now, let me pause there, Jerry. Why don't you take that a moment?
Okay. I thought that one thing that's noteworthy, the basis for which the CFPB rejected the Freedom of Information Act requests by the Cause of Action Institute were sort of interesting. They claimed that the records that were being sought, and remember, these are records that support the proposal to ban arbitration rules that waive rights to participate in class actions, that those supporting records constitute personnel records, attorney-client privileged records, records release of which would jeopardize personal privacy, and law enforcement records, which on its face seems a little specious to me.
Yeah, it seems to fit a pattern that we've seen, Jerry, with the Bureau being very selective. While claiming to be data-driven, they're very selective on the data that they make available for the public to look at. They will present the data that support their conclusions, but not present the whole body of data, which may actually tell a very different story. And yet this seems to be fitting that line. Curious that they have not published their final rule, and it's not clear. There's some debate here in my office and elsewhere about whether the Bureau would be subject to the Chief of Staff Priebus memo that was put out on January 20 calling for a pause in new regulations. Whether intended to or not, at least the Bureau seems to be following that recommendation, and that they have not put out any new regulations since the January 20 memo has gone forward.
Wayne, are you going to talk about the fair lending priorities too, or no?
I am. Yeah, I'm happy to step into that. And again, I apologize for having to go mute for a second. I'm just coming off of some bronchitis, and every now and then it catches up with me. So it caught up with me for a moment there. But here, let me turn to fair lending, and this is a very important area where, in recent days, certainly we saw this back in the latter part of last year, but we've seen this trend continue even in 2017, of the Bureau focusing significantly on fair lending issues. And on December 16th, the Bureau, which does a lot of publishing by blog post, So you got to read their blog if you want to get the latest of what's going on at the Bureau, which is, I think, somewhat innovative for federal agencies. On that December 16 blog post, the Bureau said that a lot of their 2017 focus will be on redlining, mortgage and student loan servicer treatment of delinquent borrowers, and discrimination against small businesses owned by minorities and women. I think it's a very interesting collection of issues that they want to focus on in their enforcement area. But also what's curious is what is not on that list. You'll notice that there is not a mention of auto lending and credit cards, which had been a focus of significant enforcement interest by the Bureau in recent years, particularly the indirect auto lending. The Bureau had some significant cases, most famous of which is the one involving a former auto lender that was connected with General Motors. I don't want to mention the institution, but the curious thing about that was that case was based upon an analysis, a statistical analysis under the rubric of indirect of disparate impact, where they would look at the locations, the physical geographic locations of the homes of the people who are getting the loans, and trying to discern what their race, gender, and ethnicity was from that, and discovering, and on basis of that, trying to identify what they would claim were fair lending violations. Subsequent data showed that that was very unpredictive and very flawed in its use. Maybe they're recognizing that's just too dangerous, and they're backing away from it.
Mm.
And let me pause there.
If you pause, then I will pick up with the Money Tree consent order of December 16th, which is very interesting. The CFPB imposed this consent order on Money Tree, admittedly with Money Tree's consent, because of three examples of wrongdoing, alleged wrongdoing by Money Tree. The first piece of misconduct involved deceptive advertising. Money Tree apparently advertised that it would cash tax refund checks for 1.99%, and they ran ads to that effect, including ads online. Some of the ads, however, left off the percentage sign, so the ads read that they would cash tax refund checks for 1.99%. The CFPB took the position that consumers might have thought that the fee for cashing the tax refund checks was $1.99, even though there was no dollar sign, and therefore this was deceptive. And they cite a case of one individual consumer contacting Money Tree with that false understanding. The second type of misconduct by Money Tree was that Money Tree sent the wrong form of collection letter to delinquent borrowers who had unsecured loans. The form letter that Money Tree sent these unsecured borrowers was the form letter they use to collect auto loans. And so in the form letter, there's a paragraph or a sentence threatening to repossess the borrower's car, which of course, since these loans were unsecured, was a right that Money Tree did not really have. As soon as Money Tree realized the error, they sent out corrective notices. But in the meanwhile, 151 delinquent borrowers made payments on their delinquent loans, but the CFPB perception was that it's possible that those 151 delinquent borrowers only made those payments because they were threatened falsely with repossession of their cars. The third type of wrongdoing cited by the CFPB was that Money Tree had revised its form by which consumer borrowers authorized it to take electronic payments out of their bank accounts. But the revision contained an error. It failed. It omitted language expressly authorizing the debit of the bank account. And statutes and regs prohibit a third party from taking money out of your bank account without your consent. And so this CFPB pointed out that 753 consumers signed this agreement and had money taken out of their accounts, even though the thing they signed did not expressly authorize those debits. So as a consequence, CFPB fined MoneyTree $250,000 for these violations. Wayne, I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, you certainly don't want to defend the errors that were made and the violations that took place. I was struck by what seemed to me to be, particularly in dealing with the Bureau, the relatively small amount of the civil money penalties. To you and me, $250,000 is a lot of money. To any business of medium size or larger, it almost sounds like this was the price that they were willing to pay to get the Bureau off their backs.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than to take the case and try to defend themselves. Just guessing there, who knows it, but I think it's worthwhile noting the relatively small amount of civil money penalties in this particular case.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, are you going to go on and discuss hedge funds possibly?
If I may, yeah, that's all right. I've got that on my list here and would like to talk a little bit about that. It's just one of those curious things. On January 3rd, the RD Legal Funding, it's a hedge fund that invests in legal claims. They purchase other people's legal claims. They say, you've got a legal claim here, we would purchase it, then we stand in your shoes in the legal claim and then may proceed forward. They sued the Bureau in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. The Bureau had been investigating the hedge fund on the basis that these purchases of legal claims constitutes, quote, a consumer financial product or service. Again, an example of where the Bureau seems to be spreading out its reach, and they're claiming that purchasing somebody's legal claims, that's now a financial activity, and therefore within the reach of the Bureau. RD Legal is suing back saying, no, it's not. You don't have any authority there. It's curious that the principal claims that RD Legal is investing in are claims that date back to the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, their claims that are brought against Iran for that particular attack, and also the Bureau is seeking documents for RD Legal's investments in rights of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund and also to the NFL settlement of concussion claims by NFL players. I have not heard what the bar thinks about this particular theory of the Bureau's reach. It'd be very interesting to hear what they have to say. Right now it is the hedge fund that has brought the legal case against the Bureau. It'd be very interesting to see how this plays out.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, the last thing that I thought we would talk about is the annual employee survey that the CFPB released on January 4th. The CFPB, I believe it was probably last August, surveyed their employees. 87.6% of their employees responded. They have 1,567 employees, so it was a pretty sizable response. And the survey found a great many things, but I went through it looking for things that might be critical. And it's interesting. What I found was that 69% of the responding employees did not believe that the CFPB has made substantial progress in creating a workforce where everyone feels included. 65% did not agree that in their work units, steps are taken to deal with a poor performer who does not improve. 70% did not agree that in their work units, differences in performance are recognized in a meaningful way. 78% did not agree that pay raises depend on performance, and 63% were not satisfied with opportunities to get a better job at the CFPB. So I thought that was interesting. Wayne, I might just recap and finish up here and just say what we've covered here. It was the possible removal of the CFPB director, the comprehensive National Review article, this new law review idea about triggered by consumer complaint narratives, the arbitration rule, fair lending priorities, the MoneyTree enforcement action, the asserted jurisdiction over hedge funds and this employee survey, and I guess we can leave it for the listeners to judge whether, when you consider those eight developments, the CFPB is responsive, whether it's attacking genuine problems or wasting its time on insignificant problems, whether it's efficient, rewarding good performance or punishing poor performance, and leave it at that.
It certainly continues to demonstrate its ability to attract controversy. And I guess with that, let's go to Nate, see if there are any questions from our callers.
Okay, very good. Let's check with the audience. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Currently, the lines are wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One quick announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, January 26th at 1 p.m. That call will feature discussion of the recent book from the Mercatus Center titled Reframing Financial Regulation, Enhancing Stability and Protecting Consumers. That call will feature one of the editors of the book, Hester Pierce, who is the Senior Research Fellow and Director of the Financial Markets Working Group at Mercatus. Again, if you'd like to ask a question and join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign.
Jerry, I think while we're waiting for people to offer the questions, I thought it might be worthwhile mentioning one of the other items that we had here on the list dealing with student banking. That was the annual report that the Bureau released to Congress on December 14, and again I am struck by the small numbers we're talking about. The Bureau said that they analyzed almost 500 college agreements. These are agreements between the college administration and banks that where deposit accounts and other arrangements are created for students, and they found in their report that dozens. And that's their word, dozens of those 500 agreements do not have caps on the account fees, such as overdraft fees and out-of-network ATM fees. And in the case of those dozens, 10% of the students involved paid at least 10 overdraft fees in 2014, averaging $196 in the year. And they suggested, and this is the most curious, in their report, they suggested that $196 that these students were paying could cause them to drop out of college. Now, I don't know, maybe there are some people where $196 is the difference between continuing your education or not, but that seems to me somewhat curious.
Very good point. And Wayne, I'll only comment cynically that when I hear dozens, I think 24.
Yeah, yeah, maybe 25.
Maybe.
Yeah, it was very curious.
Yeah.
So with that, we have the floor open for any questions from our callers.
And the queue is wide open. Again, if you'd like to get in line to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Gentlemen, looks like we don't have any questions pending at this point. Did you have additional comments you'd like to or subjects you'd like to cover?
Jerry, I wonder if you wanted to talk a little bit about the credit reporting agencies, the order given to Equifax and TransUnion.
I am trying to recall which issue that
That's
is.
That's the one on it's on January 3rd. That was the 12th issue on your list. I thought there were some interesting things there. Where we talk about there was an order made on January 3rd, ordered both Equifax and TransUnion. These are, of course, very large firms. To pay a combined fine and restitution of $23 million for, as I understand it, the failure to disclose to customers that the credit reports that the firms were providing to their customers were not the same credit reports that the lenders use, and for advertising that their reports were free or low cost, when they could cost as much as $16 a month.
Right. Right. Yeah, that was thank you for reminding me. That was the proposition there was that somehow the credit reporting agencies are at fault for disclosing credit reporting scores, credit scores that are different than the ones that lenders use. And of course, every lender uses different credit scores. A lot of lenders have their own proprietary credit scores. some of which are based on the credit reporting agency credit scores. It seems to be kind of unfair to fine the credit reporting agencies for disclosing the credit reports, credit scores that they release, that they provide lenders, and then punishing them because those aren't the right credit scores that the lenders use.
It is very curious, and again, this feels like, to some extent, the credit rating agencies might have been just saying, look, what does it take for you guys to go away?
Yes. I mean, just commenting a little further, I mean, there was this recent decision against Citibank, City Mortgage, just a few days ago. There does seem to be a reluctance on the part of firms that are routinely examined and regulated by the CFPB to contest these enforcement actions. And when you hear what the enforcement actions allege, you kind of scratch your head and why is that that serious? And why did the agent, why did the lender settle instead of fighting like PHH has done? When you're regulated by an agency, you don't want to have adversarial relations with it, obviously. So.
Yeah, normally speaking, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, I was also noting here the interesting post again by the Bureau, and here's their efforts to be helpful to the people who read their blog posts. They had a post entitled, "Who Are the Credit Invisible? How to Help People with Limited Credit Histories." Did you have any comments on that, Jerry? I thought it was rather interesting.
It's almost like a politically driven thing that, and we all, no matter what your politics are, you know, we all care about the downtrodden, but the CFPB sort of makes it their business to worry about the less fortunate, and so you know their concern is that some people don't have credit ratings and so therefore or credit scores and therefore they're quote credit invisible. If they apply for credit, there's not going to be any information the lender can get on their credit worthiness, and that's going to make it difficult for them to get credit.
And I think the information they provided was useful. It suggests that you try to obtain secured credit cards, small credit builder loans, and so forth. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, I wonder if they were aware of the impact of their proposed small-dollar loan regulation that would make a lot of these things that they're suggesting their customers use unreachable by them because the terms of the proposed regulation would make it, in many cases, impossible to offer those kinds of products.
Right, so that those people in need of credit who have low income would lose a source of credit under that proposal.
And I would mention that is another major rule proposal that the Bureau has pending, and that I think a lot of people thought that they would finalize before January 20, in spite of the fact that that particular rule, this is the payday lending, small dollar lending rule, had more than 1 million comment letters filed on that particular rule, which is not unprecedented. There have been a few environmental rules that have got up to 2 million filings, but it's certainly unprecedented for the Bureau and certainly unusual. But there's still some belief that they would try to finish that rule before the inauguration of the new president. And that is another major rule that so far the Bureau has now gone quiet on, and there doesn't seem to be, at least presently, any efforts to finalize that particular rule.
Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, this is Nate interrupting. We do have an audience member who would like to ask a question. Okay to take that question now?
By all means, move ahead. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, this is David Emerson, the Berkeley Federalist Society chapter. Gentlemen, thank you for your ongoing work, CFPB. It's much appreciated. My question, I don't think you would specifically address this today, but it's more of a general question about where you look in your crystal ball and see things going. And the question has to do with the disparate impact analysis and the sort of spreading effect of that. And in particular at the CFPB, whether or not there are still open cases, open rulings, open regulations that we're still waiting to see that will have an interplay with disparate impact analysis and whether or not you see a trend changing under the new administration.
Jerry, you want to lead off on that?
Sure. I don't have a crystal ball. I would think obviously, you know, the new administration would be hostile to that theory, but I do have to say it's embodied now in a rule at HUD, a formal rule. So theoretically HUD would have to, you know, repeal that regulation. And Wayne, I don't know if you're going to agree with what I'm about to say, but my experience has been that the bank regulators sort of take it, they're not aggressive in this area, but it's sort of just a given that if you engage in conduct, if you have, if your loan statistics, home mortgage loan statistics show a disparate impact on minorities, well, there's a burden on you to explain why. Even though unlike the CFPB, the bank regulators do not tout that they're following disparate impact theory, that it's my experience is it's just a given, and it's not even subject to discussion or debate, which it should be, of course. But anyway, Wayne, is your experience different by any chance?
Well, yeah, I would say I think that has been the experience. But on the other hand, looking forward, and I think that's really the import here of the caller's question, we do have the Supreme Court decision on the case in Texas, where the court laid out a specific framework for evaluating disparate impact. And in that framework, which is very important, it shifts the burden from the defendant to the plaintiff. So no longer does the defendant have to explain why the numbers look the way they look. The burden would be under the Supreme Court decision for the plaintiff to make the connection as to why those numbers point to specific actions taken by the defendant that the defendant could have avoided or could have followed a different policy and that are directly connected to some form of discrimination. We have asked each of the banking regulators and the Bureau and the Department of Justice in a formal letter asking them if they plan to embrace that framework that is embodied in the Supreme Court decision. The answer from all of them, we always have. But I think the difference going forward is perhaps with new leadership at each of these agencies, rather than claiming to be following that framework but not following that framework, you may very well see that they will follow it going forward. And the important part of that is that it shifts the burden from the defendant to the plaintiff to make the case that how the numbers are tied to other factors that clearly demonstrate that there is a causality involved that leads to violations of fair lending standards.
Wayne, I just might just add, and this gets to the substance of the disparate impact legal theory, but it's based on analogizing the Fair Housing Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act to employment discrimination statutes, Equal Employment Act, Age Discrimination Enforcement Act, but those employment acts use the word affect. AFFECT, whereas I'm pretty sure FHA and ECOA do not use that word, and so It really does seem to be like a legal stretch to apply that, disparate impact theory to lending.
One other thing in that connection that I think is important to remember as well, that in the employment connection where this theory is actually found in the statute, there is the ability to obtain damages but not civil money penalties. And the effort here by the Bureau and some of the regulators has been to take it beyond damages and try to get into civil money penalties with a theory that doesn't make that connection.
Interesting.
Does that answer the question of the caller?
This is Nate. The caller has moved on. So
okay.
I think you covered it. Currently, the queue is wide open still. Gentlemen, and audience members, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. One reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls. You can also consult our full schedule on the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org. and of course our podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls are available there as well. Gentlemen, we're running. Oh, we have another question. I was about to issue a final call for questions, but we have our next caller.
Very good. Go ahead, caller.
Hi.
Yes, please go ahead.
Oh, thank you. This is Harriet Chapman out of the Cleveland chapter, and I had to miss part of your presentation, so please forgive me if this is redundant. Can you evaluate the prospects for either Mr. Cordray's removal or the elimination of this agency altogether, or is that just not a possibility?
To lay out what in connection with that, I'm sorry, I missed the one word, the argument for?
I was curious, can you evaluate the chances that either Mr. Cordray would be removed or the chances for the elimination of the agency in the future?
Sure. Why don't I lead off, Jerry, and then you can pick up and correct any errors that I put on the table here. I think it's very curious to me, and this is based upon no specific inside information, but with regard to new regulations, the Bureau has gotten all of a sudden very quiet. And some would make the case that it's become very quiet because they don't want to create any kind of controversy of a significant level that would hasten the desire of the new administration to replace Cordray. They have been involved in various enforcement activity in the last several weeks, but I think the argument could be, well, who wants to throw somebody out because he's, quote-unquote, enforcing the law? That might be a tougher stretch rather than remove him because of what are argued to be bad policies. So I would say it looks to me like the Bureau is trying to lay low for a while, although recognizing it is still a very controversial agency. The question is either there will be action taken by the administration in the next several weeks or months to remove Cordray, or they'll wait to see what happens with the court case. I think it's very clear that the president is not bound by how the court case proceeds, but given other things that are on the president's agenda, they may want to buy some time while they're deciding what approach they want to take. There certainly are various avenues available. A lot of it seems to me to be if the administration wants to pick this fight and when they want to do it, if they do want to do that. Jerry, your thoughts?
Sure. Harriet, we did address this at the very beginning, and trying to sum it up real quickly, there are at least two schools of thought supporting President Trump's ability to remove Director Cordray. One is the PHH case, letting him remove at will. And as Wayne said, he may not need a court case to be able to do that. Then there's another theory that, well, even if he doesn't have the authority to remove Director Cordray at will, he has the authority to remove him for cause. And there's an argument that there does exist cause based on some of the things the CFPB has done. Whether President Trump would want to take on the battle, there have been in the last couple of weeks public letters, one by 21 Democrats on the House Financial Services Committee, threatening protracted litigation if the president tries to remove Director Cordray. This morning, there's a report that 40 members of the Congressional Black Caucus wrote the president saying, don't remove Cordray. So it depends on, I think, the president's appetite for how many wars does he want to fight, because I think clearly removing Cordray would bring on a battle, but that may not dissuade the president from doing it. And as far as eliminating the CFPB, Wayne, you may disagree, but I have a hard time seeing that happening. I think more likely would be passage of legislation signed by the president that would create a change the structure to make it a five-member bipartisan commission.
I agree with that, Jerry. I think the votes are not there to eliminate the Bureau. That's clearly something that would take 60 votes or more in the Senate. But there is the possibility, using the budget procedures that allow a vote of just a simple majority in the Senate, to make some of the changes at the Bureau, such as making it subject to the appropriations and authorization process, since that affects money and has a budgetary impact. That could qualify under the budgetary rules, and I could see something like that passing, and a few other things that have clear financial budget-related ties that can put it through that budget process. Otherwise, I think it's very clear that the minority in the Senate will make this a very much a party issue and would prevent there from being any 60 votes to make other changes to it. I would add one other thing, too, with regard to the likelihood of changing court rate. Even if the administration had taken the view, oh, we've got other fish to fry, other battles to fight, I think it probably just takes one significant policy action by the Bureau that has a discernible impact on economic growth and a negative one for folks at the White House, including the man who sits in the Oval Office, to say, why in the world is this part of my administration doing X or Y that's harming economic growth? We got to get that guy out of there. And I could see that happening even if prior to that the decision were made, let's work on other things for a while. That could precipitate a decision from the White House.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Harriet.
Hey, gentlemen, we are running short on time. I'll just issue a final call for questions. If you'd like to get in one quick question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Not seeing any, I will turn it over to you, gentlemen, for any concluding thoughts.
Jerry, you want to lead off with any final thought?
I have no final thought other than everyone should have a good day.
We'll appreciate that, Jerry. I would just add that one thing we can be sure of, and that is that the Bureau will continue to be a fount of controversial issues and plenty for us to talk about in future Telefora. Thank you for participating today.
Yes, this has been excellent, gentlemen. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Wayne and Jerry, for speaking with us. We welcome listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.